I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
I just moved to North Carolina about a month ago from New York, so coming from places where it snows for real. And this morning, so in New York, or like in New England, whenever there's a nor'easter, like any sort of like weather system coming through, they always have like those bands of color, right, that like indicate the number of inches of snow that will fall. And normally it's like, oh, this band is going to get 1 to 3, this one will have 4 to 6, you know, this will have 7 to 9, like whatever. Down here, they do the same thing, but the bands are literally like less than a half inch, and then like 1 inch, and then mostly rain. Like those were the bands today, and it was like a 25 minute forecast description about how it was gonna kind of snow a little bit.
Yeah, and it's like an oddity, because like, what is this stuff, right?
It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. And welcome the thing to the learned South. Everyone down here, I don't know if it's just because it was a camp, like I just saw it on campus or what, but whenever there is any sort of precipitation falling from the sky, rain, sleet, snow, anything, people use umbrellas. I have never seen people walk in the snow with umbrellas, and every single person had an umbrella.
I don't know. It's just a weird thing for them.
I mean,
I guess
like the logic stands.
You know,
like,
one of us is here.
I don't want to get wet. What?
One of us from the South is here.
Yeah, I know. Like, explain to me the weirdness.
I guess,
like I said, I understand the logic, right? Like, I don't want to get wet. The water falling from the sky, whether it is cold or kind of cold, is wet. I don't want to get wet. I'm going to use this umbrella. But I've never thought like, oh, it's snowing outside, let me grab my umbrella.
Because it never gets cold enough. Like, where you guys live, it is cold, so you don't get mix. We get mixes all the time. So you can never tell if it's mixed or not. So that's why you have to use an umbrella.
Bring my umbrella.
Well, I'm from the Midwest. And so like, when I get thunderstorms in the Northeast, they're like, oh, we're going to have a thunderstorm. And it lasts for like 5 minutes. It's like, I'll show you a thunderstorm that takes the entire state and like other states and lasts for hours and is terrifying. So it's like, oh, we have a thunderstorm coming through. It could hail, and it happens, and it's done. It's like, all right, that's it. Okay. You know, so it's kind of hilarious, weather patterns in all different parts of the country. So, I mean, my first major was meteorology because I wanted to study hurricanes. It didn't make sense in Nebraska because there's no hurricanes. So
that's so amazing, though.
You know, so.
I'm so jealous. That's so cool.
I find it fascinating. So now I'm in a place where hurricanes can happen. It's like, ooh, cool. So
just FYI, I did start recording right around when we started talking about nor'easters. So.
Okay.
Because that was just, that's just good stuff.
It is good, candid stuff. It's the best stuff when you're not like anticipating it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say this is actually a really good transition because we often will ask folks like their path, and I also need you to introduce yourself. So I would love you to take us through the story of going from I want to study hurricanes to working in higher education, which I guess is kind of like studying hurricanes.
Well, it's kind of a weird story because I started studying meteorology freshman year of 1998. It's a long time ago. And started studying hurricanes, did bad in a meteorology class. I wanted to be on TV. I switched to broadcast journalism because I want to work for ESPN. Happens to be in Connecticut, of course. Professor said, oh, it's too much. They don't make any money. It's too competitive. It's hard to get a job. So I was sold to transfer out of that major and ended up in communication studies. And then took about 6 years off. Ended up going back for my master's in educational psychology again at the University of Nebraska. And then I'm still pursuing my PhD in child development, early childhood education, which has nothing to do with academic advising. That's my job that I do. All of those three are at the University of Nebraska, so they call that the higher education suicide path. So I am still doing it because
it's amazing.
You don't do your education at all three of the same school. But hey, I did. Now I'm in Connecticut. I moved out here about 3 years ago now because I met my wife and she's here. And so I started my first job. Well, going backwards, and I was in Nebraska as an academic advisor for the College of Engineering. So if anybody from Nebraska listens, I'll just give a shout out to Engineering Student Services. Then I moved out here to my first job was at Yale University, which is quite the experience for about 8 months. I basically helped plan the retirement for a dean who was retiring, so it was good times. And then I got the first gig in higher education, like I guess legitimate job, and as director of academic advising at the University of Bridgeport. So here I am. That's my journey in a 90-second elevator speech, right?
So you did that really well.
Did I?
I'm impressed.
Yeah. So no hurricanes, no broadcasting, but I'm in Connecticut, which happens to have ESPN in it, and it happens to have hurricanes. So somehow fate said, yeah, you should still do those things, or at least be in a place where it happens. So,
but you're just like me, though. I mean, I'm a lot like you. I loved weather and everything. And you still watch the Weather Channel and all that kind of stuff whenever the hurricanes go by. And you're like, you know, what is it? Eye wall replacement cycles, all that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. You know, I was around back in the 1990s when they had meteorograms, when they did weather on paper.
Yeah, so you had right?
You had to, like, check models and, like, barometric pressure with, like different types of isobars and isotherms and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it didn't stick with me as a freshman, but now at my age, it all sticks to me now. So apparently it took a long time to process meteorology this many years later. So
we haven't had like a science nerd out podcast in a really long time. So I'm glad that it's happening again.
Well, healthcare is my other thing. That's my PhD in child development. So I have this fascination with hospitals and neonatology. So preemies, children born premature. So that's my other alternate reality world that I live in. So whenever I get students who want to be doctors, I treat them like med students. It sounds awful, but it's fun, right? Because I treat them like if they had a patient in their lives and they mess up, I let them know. And they don't like me at times, but it's the reality of med school. So they're only a freshman in college, right? So they don't really understand what I'm trying to do to them. But hey, it's what it is.
It's for your own good.
It is.
You'll thank me later.
Exactly. So yeah. So I can nerd out with the best of them when it comes to science, you know, talking to kids about their physics. I have no idea what the heck they're doing, but I like it. So, hey, you know, STEM majors they're great to work with because they do entertaining stuff. But, you know, my job right now is to hopefully advise kids to make right decisions, but also try to maintain the center that I work for and develop programs that are impactful and all that kind of stuff. So.
So what exactly does is it a center or is office, whatever? How does it work? How are you guys structured?
We're like a weird dynamic, right? So we're a grant-funded office, right? So we work for a small private school, so generally it's faculty-led advising. So our school, they applied for this grant to help strengthen student success and retention. And so they hired a bunch of us professional advisors and kind of plop us in the middle of in a university that's been having a certain advising structure done. So we had offices built. And so basically we're trying to work with all of our first gen students and provide a holistic comprehensive advising model, but also trying to like understand the culture that's already there and try to change it, that nasty, dirty word in higher education. Change things and try to make it better, right, to help improve our retention rates. And so a lot of my job as a director is almost political and diplomacy and making relationships between faculty and deans and other staff and trying to find a better way to do things. So we create a lot of programs, my staff and I do, that could actually impact students. So it's actually kind of fun to do because there's no standard for me coming into an advising center that's already been established. So you get a chance to create things on the fly. And so like today I went to one of my advisors and I went to a high school and just had college readiness talks.
And so I do a lot of that. It has nothing to do with my job, but it's something fun to do. And it gets us out of the office and gets us into communities and talks to high school seniors and juniors, sophomores and freshmen about college. So
that's really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason why I ask is because my wife is in a similar kind of position, except they don't advise. They help students find their path. Yeah. So it's kind of a student success center. It's not because we live in a our university is, I mean, we're not as small as we used to be, but we still use a faculty led advisor model. Because of the mentorship and all that kind of fun stuff. And I mean, we have a 13-to-1 faculty to staff ratio, so I guess it still works pretty well. It depends on the major. Some majors, advisors have a lot more advisees than others, but it's definitely interesting to see how other schools do it. So mm-hmm. Do you guys advise students all 4 years or just, you know, their freshman year, sophomore year, that kind of thing?
Predominantly, we get the first year freshmen. So, but I mean, I don't hold anybody back if they're juniors and seniors. I mean, I've had grad students come into my office. I'll take them in because as another grad student, right? Those are the best to have them come in and like stress out in front of you. But for the most part, it's freshmen. But we work with anybody that comes into the office. You know, as far as student success, it's one of our big initiatives that we have. So we do a lot of academic coaching. I mean, I had my staff trained by Inside Track last year. So they came in and did some full-on training for academic coaching. And even in my side gig, because everybody in higher education has side gigs, I am an independent academic coach. So I have clients, you know, in Connecticut, or I have a student in Pittsburgh right now. And so I provide academic coaching to them too, similar to first year student success. So it's kind of like teaching them skills for success, time management, helping them find the right fit in their major. You know, when, for example, if I have a student who wants to be a cardiothoracic surgeon and that actually wants to be one and not because it's on Grey's Anatomy, okay.
I don't even know what that means. What? Well, I know cardio is the heart. Cardio what?
It's apparently the common profession in Grey's Anatomy, right? So usually I tell students to become actors if they can't become like, that's anatomy, but I want to be a cardiothoracic because Dr. Dreamy was a whatever. He's a neurologist, but one of them was cardiothoracic. I just find it funny. So I just say be an actor or an actress because this pays better. And so there is that, you know, helping students find the right fit. Like I had a student once who want to be a forensic scientist, but didn't like blood. Okay, big problem there.
Yeah.
So, but we got her too smart.
I can identify with that feeling, though, just for the record. I'm with that student in spirit.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to be a doctor, though.
No, but a forensic scientist would be so cool.
But she would have to deal with, you know, crime scenes and victims and bodies, right?
I said, hey, want to do the science part.
I said, hey, why don't you become a mechanical engineer and design, you know, technology to help forensic scientists do that? So she's like, cool. So she did that. And then she changed majors. And that's kind of what we do for first year freshmen, right? To help them find the right fit. So it's just kind of having conversations, right? It's not can't be meticulous when it comes to freshmen. You can't go through a checklist and say, do this, and do this, and see what happens, right? Each kid's different. So it's, you just have to sit down and talk to them. And,
well, you know, some extent, so, being a freshman's about being disillusioned, I guess.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, they all want to be either a neurologist, they want to be an anesthesiologist. That's a fun one. That's very common because it makes the most money.
Yep.
I also say they get sued the most, too, so the highest malpractice insurance. So there's a trade-off, right?
Very, very honest and straight up. I appreciate that.
It's true. And you get sued more because the patient doesn't come back. You're going to get sued for that. So I'd say just be a PA. You don't get sued for that. The physician does. And so it's very, you have to be very honest with them. And they don't, I know a lot of times they pick majors because of the earning potential, especially first gen students. They're picking stuff because it could make a ton of money and not sure what it is. Mm-hmm.
So with this time of year, do you have a lot of like upperclassmen coming in your office and like panicking?
Well, right now, the second semester for the first year, students kind of go MIA on us, right? Figure it out the first semester, now I don't need you now until like mid grades come out. Like, okay, I'm failing, now I need you. And then they got to register, now I need you some more. And then, you know, kind of get used and abused a little bit, right? And they cast you out. But that's fine, you know. So what we try to do is we'll find them. In small private schools, you have the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I work at a big school in Nebraska, Big Ten, so it's tons of students, right? You can't just get out of your office and go find your students. But at a small school like this, you can go find them in the residence halls or the dining halls or any kind of events to go to and talk to them.
That sounds a little creepy, I won't lie.
Well, I don't go to the residence halls. I have residence hall directors go and do their thing, but I don't go to the dorms.
I can go stalk but, them very easily.
Yeah, you know, you just show up and they just start making small talk, right? So, that's what I do. I'm just a small talker. You know, it's my innate ability from my father to be he has got his BS degree, right, in farming, but he never went to college. And so I have that.
Do I have permission to steal that joke to use in the future?
You can. It's not a trick. It's not, you could quote, put on a t-shirt, you know, I've got a BS, but I never went to college. Right.
That sounds like some new merch that we can sell in our non-existent higher ed social store, Logan.
Yes.
Yeah, I got a percentage, 5%.
Yeah, we'll give you a cut. Oh, for sure. For sure. We'll be rolling in it.
Get it, go to my PhD fund to do research.
Yeah, we'll Venmo it to you.
No, go to my PhD fund, right, to help fund especially PhD students. It's what it is, I guess. Higher education is about building relationships. I guess it's one of the things I value in my staff, or at least that I want to see, is relationship building. Because anybody can schedule kids for classes. That's not hard. I can find a guy off the street and say, can you fill out this form? Yeah, okay. Hired. But if you can't build relationships in this business and higher education, then because retention is the big word, right? Retention. Ooh. Everybody's big word, retention, persistence, grad rates, enrollment numbers. It's what drives money, right? So it's
what keeps us in business.
So I have a job, right? We all have jobs because kids stick around a little bit longer. So, but there's more and more variables that prevent things, and not to go all political, keep it clean. But there's too many variables that kind of hurt education today that keep kids from going to college. You know, Perkins loans getting stripped, Pell Grants getting cut. There's this new, I think it's Persist Act, that basically, or something like that, if students drop out of classes before the 60% completion, that the universities have to pay back the loans or something like that. I mean, that's going to hurt schools. So it's getting tougher and tougher, I think, for kids to finish and go to school, and affordability is hard. So I think universities have a unique challenge to recruit kids, convince them to go to college, and convince them to stay.
Hey, it's Jackie. Thanks so much for listening to Higher Ed Social. We really appreciate it. I just wanted to take a minute to tell you about this really cool podcast player called Radio Public. And I know you probably already have your podcast player that you go to all the time, but take a listen to Radio Public because it's way different than any other podcast player out there. You can find it both in the Apple App Store as well as Google Play Store. And the thing that's so cool about Radio Public is that it actually starts to learn a little bit about you. You can organize your podcasts into playlists, or if you just want something new, you can head over to the app and pick up a different playlist. They have one called Lazy Sunday or Podcast Club. So whatever you're feeling, you're going to be able to find something. What I think is the best part about using the Radio Public app, though, is when you're looking for something new and you just want to ask your friends, what new podcast should I listen to? Radio Public's got your back. So you can ask the podcast librarians, yes, actual people, what new podcast should I listen to? And because they have done extensive research and listened to tons of podcasts, they're going to give you a great suggestion. So you can head over to radiopublic.com or download the app in both the Apple App Store and Google Play Store and just give it a shot. You know, you'll never know what you're going to find. All right, let's get back to the show.
Did you feel like you had some, well, did you have a you when you were in your first year, second year of college?
A person like me, no. I mean, I had an advisor, her name is Karen. So I don't know. I mean, she terrified me, right? I saw her like twice. She had like those big glasses on, you know, seeing you walk in, her eyes were massive. And she like had this tiny room. It was all a mess. She wasn't nice. I didn't go to her very often as an advisor. I never had to.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got scheduled, I could do it myself. So I never really had this like intense, intrusive person, you know, constantly checking on me or seeing how I'm doing. I think it's changed a little bit too. I think we have to, I don't know, I feel like universities feel like they have to do that much work to get kids, to motivate kids to do things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough, but no, there wasn't, I don't think there was a you like me. I don't know if I'm whatever I am, I guess, but there is that. So Karen was my me. So.
Like, I know I had a, I guess I don't know that, well, I guess maybe I don't know the difference between like an academic advisor and just like that person assigned to me from my major that was making sure I was taking classes. Like I never necessarily went to them with like, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, but maybe that was just my own fault for not taking advantage of them.
Well, I think that might be the, I mean, I didn't know all those different facets too. We had career offices, we didn't have advising centers. We just had a person who's in charge of everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have the person who does the schedules. So that's a big, big conversation amongst anybody, what's academic advising really is, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm part of NACADA right now. That's our professional organization. So it's a constant question, like what is advising? Is it scheduling? Or is it bigger than that? And I believe it's bigger than just filling out a piece of paper, a schedule. It's not a transaction. So there is that facet of it, but it needs to be more of a mentorship than anything. That I think they should stick with the student for 4 years if possible. A lot of times you don't have the staffing to do that because there's too many students, but
right.
No.
Yes.
It is interesting that you bring up that point about like students not understanding mm-hmm. the difference. And I think that's probably a pitfall that many, many institutions fall into is we have like these organizational structures that like when you're inside of the mm-hmm. campus as like a business, like, okay, mm-hmm. sure. That kind of makes sense. But do these students really understand like where they need to go when they don't know what they want to do with their future? Like it kind of makes more sense to me to go to the career center because I want to get a job, you know, like I would think my academic advisor is someone I have to talk to when I'm failing a class.
Yeah. And there's two folds to that too. Like if I'm a faculty advisor, right, and I'm a psychologist and a student comes to me, I'll be able to articulate what the careers are like. Like, yes, you have to go to graduate school if you want to do this. But sometimes the students need like a resume critiqued or they're like getting prepared for a career fair. They're just like doing a needs assessment to kind of figure out, you know, maybe I'm not in the right major. What's the right fit for me? You know, career services or career development's good for that. Mm-hmm. You know, so advisors are kind of like that entry point of referrals. And I think they're good about that too, because it's more of an adjustment to college. Kind of figured, oh, you have anxiety or depression, you probably need counseling. And it's free, it doesn't cost you anything, right? So sometimes it's teaching awareness of what all their services they have.
Right.
But this is kind of being an advocate for the students. So that's why I do the high school stuff, right? Because we'll do tons of workshops on student success now for freshmen. And they're like, I'm too cool. I don't need it. My friends think this is stupid. You don't have to go. But I go to high schools now, right? Because they're attentive. And this is set up by their counselors. It's set up by, I go to community organizations. It's all agreed upon and set up. So I have attentive groups of people to listen and help hopefully prepare them. And then, of course, set up opportunities for these students to contact myself or my team now all the way up until the first day of fall, right? So it's kind of extending that retention process further back than a first day of class, because I think you kind of have to do that, provide opportunities for students to access you as advisors from way before day one. And so that's what we do. So like when a team of mine went out, I might bring faculty with me to these events just to talk to students and get a familiar face and start to build those relationships. So I had probably like 10 or 12 students today from this school I went to today. Mm-hmm. And so it's a process of building things, and hopefully they stick and, you know, they come to school here, but they also feel like they belong here too. So,
So what kind of metrics do you guys use any metrics for assessment, anything like that, to kind of see how well you're doing? Because how long have you been there?
Well, we're in our third year now of this grant. We'll be finishing up the third year here in the fall. So we got two more years left of it. You know, mm-hmm. so we've been meeting our benchmark. So I have five objectives I have to obtain or achieve through my grant. You know, of course, increase retention, improve graduation rates, lower probation, improve the endowment, and then of course, my favorite one is improve faculty development. That's my best. Because mm-hmm. it has nothing to do with students, and they love to hear from me all the time. So it's those are the metrics that I go for just for the grant per se. But I also like to look at the effectiveness of programs. So I do collect data on like our probation program to kind of see, yes, do these initiatives impact students? Did they actually return a good academic standing because of this? You know, student success type stuff. I'm trying to measure community engagement, student engagement on campus, academic achievement. I want to get scholarships created for our students and kind of entice them by performing at this optimal level. They get rewarded, so they don't have to be the top in the class to get a scholarship. They can be the top 20 and get scholarships. So it's not so selective. And so I'm trying to find ways to motivate kids, but also measure this. Even faculty development, you know, I try to measure their activity in my weekly faculty development hours. And, you know, if they present, I take points, a point system on that to kind of gauge who's been the most active. And I'm hoping to get that part of their tenure process for professional development. And so a lot of these things I'm trying to get preliminary data on it right now, but I need a good data set for a couple of years to really assess the effectiveness of a program, because I can't really see it in the first semester.
Right, definitely.
Yeah, so because my hope is after all this grant's said and done that they institutionalize everything and that these programs become a standard. And so it takes data and it takes money to back them. But I feel like I'm getting there. You know, it's not a bad gig. It's like I said, I like to create things. I don't like to do the same stuff. It's just not how I operate. So the first thing I did, and I started this job, I assessed the campus to kind of see what are they lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd like to see a diversity initiative pushed, cause our school is fairly diverse, but that doesn't mean it stops there. I like to be, I'm a very proactive, progressive person. I'm a Northeast nurse, you know, it was, and, we're pretty progressive. I don't think I'd fit back in the Midwest anymore. And it's, well, you know,
just depends on the school.
Depends on the school, and schools are always good, I think. It's typically the environments outside where I kind of grew up in, that small town. I don't think I'd fit in there anymore. You know, you try to do things that are going to be high impact practices for schools. And yes, I'm always thinking, like, I looked at our school, we're lacking veteran services. So like, what can we do for our vets? You know, do we have a women's center? No, we don't. Can we get something in programs in place for that? And so I'm constantly looking for opportunities to create things that actually have an impact on our students and really help them commit to their education for 4 years and not want to transfer somewhere else. I'm trying to get my office aligned with student affairs, because we honestly don't have a department, because we're like, we're here, we're trying to fit in here, we want to do good work, but we're not sure who we belong to. And so I'm trying to work with our dean of students and get us partnered with student affairs because of the student success part, right? And that's a very much a student affairs initiative. And so I'm trying to align us underneath that, so we have under organizational structure, we're part of that department.
Well, that definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the standard, isn't it?
Yeah, we're partially academic affairs because of the advising part, but I think academic advising has changed quite a bit, that we're more NASPA-ish instead of, you know, we're NACADA-ish too, which is my organization. We're very much NASPA people too.
Yeah.
Because of the student engagement aspect, and, you know, so I kind of want, we're like a hybrid.
Our office, the GPS office, Growth and Purpose for Students, which is, I guess, comparable to what you are, except less advising-y, like I said. They just recently moved under student affairs, so that totally makes sense.
So I keep pushing it. So we'll see. We got a new president coming on board. So now's the time for some change, and now's the time to make some moves to see what we can make. So we can have accomplished. So we can have structure. So when a new president comes on board in the summer, she's like, "All right, this looks good. This looks good." So I'm trying to align our efforts, because there's a lot of younger staff too in student affairs, and we work with them already anyways. We work with career development on our student athlete success program. We work with Res Life and developing learning communities. It's kind of like we kind of belong there. And they just want us officially underneath that or somehow aligned with it structurally, so I know it's legit.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. So many changes. So how many years have you been, or how many years are you into your grant?
We're in year 3 now, so it's a 5-year grant. So after this fall, we got 2 more to go, and so goals to solidify that we stay, right? And it's like, I'm a big advocate, so I'm always out. It feels like I'm running for like a political seat or something, right? Just trying to campaign.
Yeah, you want everybody to know who you are.
Yeah, who we are, what we're doing. You know, if I have to go to lunch with the dean, I go to lunch with the dean and get coffee with a faculty member, or it's that kind of stuff, right? And continuously advocate for my office. So I spend a lot of time doing that. I don't advise much. I don't have a caseload per se, because when I went to my annual conference for NACADA, it says if you're in administration, you try to manage a caseload, you can't do both. And so I had to let go of a caseload, and I still see students. It's not like I don't see them. But it allows me to free myself up to do these programs, to really push initiatives, to promote our offices on the campus, that kind of stuff. So that's a give and take.
So what would you say is like the, I don't want to say the greatest improvement, but like over these last 3 years, and then considering going into the last 2, like something that surprised you or has grown or a big win for your office?
Well, for our office, obviously improving our retention rate. It's still not great, but it's the highest it's been, I guess, in the history of our school. It's only 71%, but it's improvement. My goal, I want 80-85%. So it takes a huge push, but it's a small little victory, because we exceeded our 5th-year grant goal already in the first 2 years. But you know, biggest accomplishment is, I think, it's my faculty development series, because that's always the toughest thing to do, right? Because it's trying to say professional development for professors who have PhDs or doctorates and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, hey, who are you? I'm generating excitement for them, and they're buying into it. And I get presenters every week to talk about their ideas or their research. So there's people involved. So that's the biggest win for me to do. Because working with students is easy to do for me, but it's convincing people with years of experience, years of expertise, to do something without being incentivized is kind of a big thing for me. So, you know, I think if we get, if I get my scholarship for the students, that'd be a big win. Because that solidifies funding that comes through my office. But also my goals for, I guess, going forward is to do research out of my office. I'm now one of the first-gen steering committee research members for NACADA nationwide. So I hope to do some research out of my office too. You know, publish, that'd be great too, to get that kind of stuff coming out of our office. It makes this kind of it solidifies our foothold there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So neat.
So I've got one last question for you. So what makes you come into work every morning? Like, what drives you?
I think it's just to work with students, right? You know, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, because, you know, you work in higher education, it's not for money, unless you're senior administration, then you're doing okay. But for us who work in the trenches, as I call it, You know, if you get a kid who comes in the first day of class, you know, they struggle, they persist, and then you see them like graduate, you know, and get their diploma, you know, that kind of stuff, right? You know, you see, you know, not a lot of times I tell students not to relive how I did my education, because there's opportunities that I've missed when I was a student. You know, I wasn't involved as much. I changed majors 3 times. I landed on probation 1 semester. Not the model student, right? But it's the idea of teaching kids persistence and watching them get through tough times. And I guess developing their identity, right? So I do a first year seminar, student developmental theory, right? And it's consistently learning, teaching students how to develop their identity in 4 years. And I guess watching students grow through that process is what gets me to come to work every day. So
that's awesome.
That's so nice. Yeah. We were just talking about this last week about the opportunity for us, whether we're faculty or staff, to be able to connect with a student and give them the chance that, you know, either our mentors gave us or like the ones that we wish we had, because really those years in college can really change your future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of our students, again, are first gens, and it's, I talk about this term publisher, or not publisher Paris, that's for PhD people. It's pride and pressure. Too many P's. Pride and pressure.
Way too many.
Too many P's, right? Publisher Paris is for the other students. But it's pride and pressure for first-gen students, because there's a lot of pride because they're the first to go. But there's a lot of pressure because they don't want to fail, right? And be consistently fall into the same routine that everybody else does. And so you see our first-gen students who they're there, they have no idea what they're doing. They want to get their degree because they want to provide for their family in a way that their parents kind of. So there's a ton of pressure. And so getting kids to get through that first year, first semester for sure, it's a good feeling.
Yeah. I think that's a really nice way to end the show. I think we're out of time this week.
Yeah. So yeah. Well.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brian, so much for taking the time to chat with us this week. We really appreciate it and all the insight you have. And listeners, head over to our website, higher ed.social. You can get all the cool links to the stuff we talked about today. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our show either right through our website or pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. So go ahead and find us there. And of course, if you do use Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. We really want to know how we're doing. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, and give us 5 stars, because it makes it easier for other people to find our show and start listening. And of course, follow us on Twitter. We're at HES Podcast. Definitely send us a tweet. We love talking to folks on Twitter, especially if you want to be on the show. Let us know. You can just send us a tweet and say, hey, I want to do this cool thing with you guys, and we will be there. Higher Ed Social is produced by Emma Hawes. Thank you, Emma. And we are part of the Connect EDU network. Super exciting network for podcasters in higher ed. It's the first one out there. You can visit connectedu.network online to learn more and subscribe to some awesome shows no matter where you work on a college campus. Have a great week.